Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and I'm glad you're listening today. Later in the show, what a police researcher sees when he watches the George Floyd video. But first, the first trillions flowed out of Congress with remarkable speed. But what if it takes trillions more to reignite the American economy? Congressional leaders are in deep disagreement over what is now required for millions of still unemployed Americans, shuttered businesses, and economic prospects that seem dim through at least the end of 2020. Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell has pronounced that the House stimulus bill, which spends another trillion and some change, is going nowhere, and the White House opposes it too. In the Atlantic last week, economics writer Derek Thompson got some attention when he argued that it may take $10 trillion before it's all over to save the economy. He wrote, "Even Americans who are suffering from the health and economic ravages of the pandemic may feel a bit stunned by the dollar amount. Does the government really have to spend $5 trillion in 3 months? Can the United States afford to dump such unfathomable amounts of money into this economy? The answers to those questions are yes and absolutely yes." Derek Thompson joins us along with another guest who's more skeptical of such spending. I think we all want to hear from you as taxpayers and as citizens and as people who have been affected by the economy. Does your own financial situation, now maybe that's as a small business owner, maybe that is as an employee of a company, does it feel shaky enough that you will need more help from the state and federal government to get back on your feet? And as a taxpayer, are you worried about the implications of all of this spending? So I'd really like to hear about where you are at this moment. Are you furloughed from a job that you expect you'll go back to? Have you had to shutter your business? Are you worried as a small business owner you may never open the doors again? How do you feel about the spending? Do you need more help from the federal and state government? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, anywhere in the upper Midwest, and on Twitter, at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Derek Thompson is with us. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he often writes about economics, and his article is headlined, "We Can Prevent a Great Depression. It'll Take $10 Trillion. I'll post it on Twitter. And he joins us today from Washington. And Derek, welcome back to the show. It's been a while, but thanks so much for the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Matthew Mitchell is with us. He's director of the Equity Initiative at George Mason University, and we find him in Taos, New Mexico today. Matthew, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'd like you both to assess what you think the current state of the economy is. Derek, in a sentence or two, how would you describe where we are economically at the moment?
It's impossible to do in a sentence or two other than saying this is the strangest economy in certainly 100 years and maybe in the history of the country.
Okay, you have to ask why. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you have a situation where not only do you have perhaps the highest official unemployment rate in American history, you also have the largest government stimulus in American history in terms of the fiscal response, at least the largest in a non-wartime. You also have the fact that there's just never really been a time when the federal government, along with the states, has essentially overseen an official shutdown of the out-of-home economy, shutting down retail, shutting down all sorts of face-to-face interactions. So we've never really seen anything like this, which I think, you know, should make us humble about using history to predict what's going to happen next. But to return to the thesis statement, this is just a very strange economy, and underneath that strangeness, obviously, you have a lot of suffering.
Matthew, how would you characterize where we are, and would you agree with the strangeness that Derek describes?
I would. You know, I think that's exactly the right word to use. maybe the best way to think about it is what is to describe this economy as what it is not. So, you know, clearly it's a deep recession, but it's not like any previous recession. Quite often, recessions are caused by a precipitous fall in what economists call aggregate demand, which is the economy's basic desire to buy and purchase things, make investments. And it's not bad. That wasn't at least the initial cause. Some other recessions are caused by supply shocks. So the 1970s supply shocks caused by OPEC and the embargo on oil, it's not exactly that either. It's really this strange situation where people have been ordered not to buy stuff. People have been ordered not to sell stuff. And then those who, even beyond that, I think there would be a fair amount of fear about buying and selling, even if the orders or the lockdowns weren't there. So it is, Derek's right. It's very strange.
I'm going to take a call here because this is something that I wanted to get to a little deeper in the show, but we can certainly talk about it now. To Mary in Brooklyn Center. Hi, Mary. Sounds like you're concerned about getting stimulus checks. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. We just received one yesterday for $2,400. My husband and I are both retired. We didn't lose a job, and we shouldn't have gotten the money. We did not need it. And those that don't lose jobs should not get stimulus checks.
I appreciate the call, Mary. Matthew, my mother was saying the same thing. She's retired, didn't really need the money, tucked it away in a bank account. Is the federal government giving money to people who, at the moment, don't need it as much as others do?
Absolutely. This is a odd scenario where people who have the luxury of working remotely are, people like, frankly, me, are able to continue work, continue taking a paycheck, can opine on these types of things, and yet the pain is concentrated on those who are least able to handle it, those with the smallest amount of savings. So, rather than sending people like me a paycheck for basically, when I don't need it, what we need to be doing is concentrating aid on those who are least able to handle this. And we need to be clear about this. I don't think anything that we do will be particularly stimulative.
Why do you say that?
Well, because in a traditional sense of stimulus, when you give money to people, the hope is that it will somehow fill a hole that is left in aggregate demand, that maybe you can get people out there buying and overcoming their fear of spending. But in this case, that's not what's happening. No amount of money to me is going to allow me to really help the unemployed waiter or waitress from down the street. Instead, rather than thinking about stimulating the economy, I do think that there probably is a role for thinking about helping provide some relief to those who are in pain and some liquidity to those who are in pain, basically helping them get through some difficult times so that they can see their way to the other end.
Okay, I'm going to come back to that with Derek. But Derek, I don't want to miss this question. Do you believe that the unemployment numbers are giving us an accurate picture, or do we have underemployment and more jobs missing than the statistics actually represent? Because we're about to get more job numbers here in a few days.
It's such a good question, and I'm sorry that I have to go right back to my thesis about this just being an unbelievably weird situation. But trying to use official government statistics to estimate 2020 unemployment right now it's a little bit, you're using a 100-year-old method or decade-old method to study something that's just, it just wasn't necessarily built to measure in real time. I'm not trying to sow some sense of distrust in the government statistics. I think I'm just telling you what the economist, the BLS, would say, which is that they're doing their best to measure what's happening, but they don't have the precise tools to measure it. So why? Well, one answer is that we don't know how durable these layoffs are going to be. When a company furloughs its employees for 3 months, like some media companies are doing right now, you know, is that a layoff, just like, you know, a manufacturing layoff in a typical recession? Or is it really just, you know, a furlough for 10 weeks and they'll be right back to work? No one knows. When you have employees who, you know, are working at, I don't know, at a retail store in New York or Phoenix or Detroit, and they're being paid, but maybe they're not coming into work for a few weeks. Are they on the razor's edge of unemployment? Should we think of them as belonging to this sort of broader measure of unemployment because they literally can't work? Or are they going to be right back to work in 2 weeks? We don't know. So there's just so much uncertainty about the pain that this recession has inflicted on the workforce that it's just really difficult to use 20th century tools to measure something that's unprecedented.
Let me grab another call here from John in Duluth. Hi, John. Sounds like you are a small business owner. Is that right?
Well, I'm not an owner, but I work for a small business very close to the owner. There's four of us really in the operation, 10 total people, but four salespeople.
How do things look?
It's tough up here, really tough. The ripple effect that we're feeling from our state policy being kind of a micromanagement policy in terms of letting business open and getting things going again has been devastating. The healthcare system up here has been devastated. Tons of layoffs of nurses and doctors. The restaurant business, the tourist business has been decimated. We waited on the edge of our seat for the June 1st announcement to help bars and restaurants. Mm-hmm. And that ended up being outdoor seating, which is wonderful in Duluth. Not going to work. So
yeah, so
we're getting by day to day, but the picture right now, it has to turn around. Something has to turn around for us and everybody else. The ripple effect of, I think, our micromanagement policy in Minnesota is just really not working for small business.
John, just a question here, because I was listening to what Derek was saying about try to assess, are people on the razor's edge? Is the business, you know, close to closing its doors? How many days do you think, or months, weeks do you have if more help isn't coming?
Well, in our current structure, we won't be, you know, our overhead is significant enough where we will have to reinvent ourselves to survive, for sure. We would have to downsize, take a nice big building off the property tax rolls and maybe function from a smaller facility, something pretty radical. Otherwise, our numbers are not adequate to sustain us. And we feel it from our customers. We talk to a lot of different businesses that are in exactly the same position. Food service that supply food to schools and restaurants, that type of thing. Yeah. That happens to be one of our good customers. They're decimated. And again, that June 1st decision of barely helping that industry get back going did nothing. So we started in March, pushed the curve. We've been beaten down for 3-4 months, and now we're talking maybe a surge in Minnesota in July. So
right.
What does that say? Are we just going to, you know, we're going to tell us all to make it till August or September? A lot of people are not going to make it, and I don't know how much help is going to save us.
John, I'm really glad you heard the show and you had a moment to call in. It's good to have your perspective. Matthew, tell me what you hear in John's experience and whether you're hearing a lot of businesses have to make those kinds of decisions.
Well, certainly, you know, businesses have long-term obligations. You know, the most obvious for many of them is the obligations to their employees. You know, they would like to keep them on, but it's difficult to do that when you have no revenue coming in. Other obligations, of course, are to rent and to other loans. And I think what this just shows is that this is not a sustainable policy. You know, I think it's something that people can weather for a few weeks in many cases, but as a long-term solution, you know, states, whether they whatever the merits of the lockdown are, there is some point where you're going to face not only diminishing marginal returns to fighting COVID, but also extraordinarily increasing marginal costs. We're just getting to the point where the costs of endless lockdowns are getting prohibitive for many segments of society.
Derek, one of the things that you do in this piece is you go through the reasons why the CARES Act wasn't enough and in making your argument that trillions more are going to be needed, including the fact that many small businesses weren't able to get a share of the paycheck protection measures. What happened? Why is that? Do you have a sense that the federal government has that figured out?
I think it's fair to say two things. One, that the payroll protection program was a surprisingly and refreshingly innovative program that was stood up unbelievably quickly in order to dispense hundreds of billions of dollars to small businesses in the middle of a crisis, and that people acted, and people in Washington, who you would not expect to act particularly quickly in any circumstance, mm-hmm. in fact, did so in a rather impressive way. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's also obvious that the first tranche of PPP was in many cases a failure. Dispensing blame for that failure, how much was it a result of the fact that a lot of small businesses, larger small businesses that have pre-existing relationships with banks were the ones to grab the money? That's, a problem that the government can't necessarily fix. On the other hand, I do think there were parts of PPP and the way that it was sort of communicated to the small business community that was extremely confusing. And that's definitely a fault of the Small Business Administration and of the government and the people who wrote the law. But in this article, that makes the claim that this could cost up to $10 trillion, that this sort of economic rescue over several years could cost up to $10 trillion. What I say is that CARES did a lot, but we need to do a lot more. And we need to do a lot more for four groups. And we'll just talk about them really, really quickly.
Sure.
One is families. We need to extend unemployment insurance past the July date, which is when the bump up in unemployment insurance ends, given the CARES Act. I also think maybe we can cut more checks to families. That's going to cost a lot of money. Number two, after families, is you have these businesses. I'd like to see more help being offered to small businesses, because we can't have small business bankruptcies wash over the economy. The spillover effects, not just the tragedy of those failures, but the spillover effects for local communities is going to be devastating. Three, we have to do something about state and local governments. The decline in sales tax and income tax revenue will be devastating to budgets that are responsible for schools and hospitals and fire departments. We've got to do something about that. And then finally, this is an economic crisis, but it is undergirded by a public health crisis. And we have to have some funding for rural hospitals and for the scientists that are working on antivirals and vaccines. So you add all that up, families, businesses, state and local governments, public health, that is a project that will be worth trillions of dollars in the next year, and possibly trillions more when you're looking out past 12 months from now.
Derek Thompson with us. He wrote that piece that he's talking about. It's called We Can Prevent a Great Depression. It'll Take $10 Trillion. And as you heard, he's going through some of the different dimensions of where money will be needed most. That is a huge price tag. We invited him here to talk about that, along with Matthew Mitchell from George Mason University, where he's director of the Equity Initiative. And hearing your thoughts on this and your experience, perhaps as the owner or employee of a small business, do you feel shaky enough that you're going to need more help to get back on your feet? Do you need another check cut, another stimulus check cut? To your family, what about if you own a business? What's it going to take to keep that business open? And I'd love to hear your experience with this as a taxpayer. Are you worried about the implications of all of this spending? And I'm seeing some questions about this on Twitter as well, so we'll talk about that. 651-227-6000. Where do you fit into this? What's it going to take, do you think, to protect your share of the economy? 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR, where Jill says, I'm worried that most of the money they're injecting into the economy via stimulus money is just going to go into the pockets of the billionaires, most notably Jeff Bezos. Hopefully everyone local can spend as much of this money locally as possible. And to Lorraine in Northfield, Minnesota. Hi, Lorraine, do you have a question about this?
I do. Since I first heard of pulling the money out of the national government's treasury, where does the money get pulled from? Which budget is now lost for which government department, and which job do we need done? Oh, my gosh, that's huge amounts. Which we didn't take care of health care in this country. We haven't taken care of the infrastructure, the Ike's highways and bridges, you know, way back when were put in place. They really need help. Our national parks are chronically in need.
So we have a lot of needs.
Need cleaning.
Yeah.
There's so many government needs out there, and here we've got trillions. Where are they coming from?
Okay.
What are we not going to do because of it?
So, Matthew,
why didn't we
Lorraine,
do it before the pandemic?
I have some other people on the line here, so I do want to get to Matthew here. Matthew, it's borrowed money, isn't it?
That's right. You know, she's right to ask where does the money come from, and the truth is there's an opportunity cost to every dollar spent. So this money really comes out of future, either out of the future. So it either means that we have to raise taxes in the future, or we have less money to spend on programs in the future. We're already spending an enormous amount on interest payments for the federal debt. We're already pushing up, you know, our debt to GDP ratios to points where economists think that it begins to have an effect on a dampening effect on the economy. You know, there is a real cost to this. It doesn't just come out of nowhere.
Matthew, did Derek make a persuasive case to you, given cutting checks to families, more help for businesses, state and local governments are going to need the help, and health care needs an investment? Is that persuasive to you that it's going to take overall $10 trillion to do that?
Well, I'm sorry to say I remain skeptical. I think the most persuasive case to be made was where he began the argument, which is that this is a strange economy. And we recognizing how strange it is, I think we need to start with understanding with some humility in our ability to predict how we can affect it. So, you know, under the best of circumstances, which is where you think stimulus is going to be most effective. And that's in a scenario where you have a very predictable aggregate demand-driven recession, and you think you can basically put unemployed resources to work quickly. That's the best-case scenario, and the economic evidence on even that type of stimulus is highly debated. You know, this is a really, really controversial aspect of economics. Some would argue it's an area of economics where we actually have the least understanding. You know, there are areas in microeconomics where there's a great deal of consensus, and macroeconomics is not an area of consensus. So, you know, you take this treatment, this idea of a stimulus that is already pretty controversial under a normal recession, and you try to apply it to this type of very strange recession. I just think it's extremely risky. You know, it does certainly entail some opportunity costs, as the last caller suggested, and I don't think it's going to be very effective, unfortunately.
Derek, I don't want to miss something that Matthew said a few minutes ago about how he doesn't believe, while he does believe some of this spending is necessary, he doesn't believe it's actually stimulus spending, that it's not going to stimulate the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew, do I have that right? Am I repeating that correctly?
Yeah, I think that's fair, yeah.
So, Derek, what do you think?
Yeah, I think a reasonable frame to use for analyzing the state of the economy is something that Matthew brought up. It's humility. I don't know what's going to happen with the recovery. And I also think it's fair to say that we don't know exactly what the risks of high deficits are in an economy with really, really low inflation. The government can borrow for extraordinarily low costs right now. And you can say, well, in the future, we might have inflation, we might have to raise taxes. That's a guess. Here's what we know for sure. 1 in 5 Americans appear to be out of work. Core inflation recently dropped by its lowest rate in the history of the statistic. So we're dealing with a near-term crisis that looks much more like deflation than inflation. Mm-hmm. And we also know that throughout the Trump administration, we were seeing sky-high deficits under Republicans that did not incur dramatic increases in inflation or in borrowing costs for the government. So it is possible that while for much of the 20th century, and indeed certainly in the 1970s, 80s, early 90s, you did see interest rates soar for the U.S. when we ran consecutive deficits. That just doesn't seem to be happening now. We are, for a variety of reasons, maybe because of technology, maybe because of demographics, in an environment where practically every single advanced country in the world is dealing with the opposite of high inflation. They're all dealing with either lowflation or borderline deflation. That is an environment where it seems to me, much safer to borrow large amounts of money, especially when those large amounts of money are being deposed to prevent a Great Depression. We have people who don't have money, who are unemployed. We don't know when they're coming back to work. We have states and local governments and businesses that are dealing with the possibility of near-term bankruptcy. That's what we know. We know we have this near-term emergency. And I am afraid, just in closing, that our fears about some future flood of inflation and taxes that might come in the future might keep us from dealing with the drought we know we have right now. I say fix the drought, worry about the possibility of flood in the future.
Antonio says on Twitter, stimulus check, I haven't worked since 4/4/20. $1,200 came and went, still waiting for unemployment. There's nowhere to send an SOS. And to Rick in Minneapolis on the phone line here. Hi, Rick.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. Tell me where you come into this discussion from. You're a small business owner?
Yeah, I own a small business in Minneapolis. We're in an industrial specialty niche, and we do some manufacturing and some distribution. We were fortunate to be able to get a PPP loan, and we're confident that that'll be forgiven. However, we've seen just a massive fall off in business since the middle of March. I mean, we're from mid-March to today, relative to last year, we're down about 45%. And what it means is, in spite of all the kind of future cash flow projections that I'm working on based on our existing backlog, it means that we're going to be cutting the size of the company in half. And we only have 9.3 equivalent, full-time employees. So things are pretty bleak.
So Rick, a question here, because I think we alluded to this idea that paycheck protection did not help companies with the kind of overhead costs that you've been talking about. Is that what happened with you? I mean, the money went to some necessary sources,
right?
But not enough of them.
Yeah, it covers the overhead in effect, our overhead is our rent and our utilities, and it worked out that in the 8-week period, our payroll will be almost exactly 75% of the total loan amount, and everything worked out nicely. But beyond that, because of the drastic fall off in business and future revenues that we can see, it's pretty ugly.
Derek, Rick, thanks so much for calling. Derek, is that, and again, hearing what you said about how quickly they responded, there was innovation here. Is that one of the problems, though, of the way some of these packages were designed?
Yeah, it's just very, very difficult, I think, in a country like the U.S. To stand up a program that gives hundreds of billions of dollars to small businesses across the country in a way that doesn't rely on local banks. And a lot of these local banks tend to have relationships with larger companies that are more involved in the relationships with smaller companies. And you add on to that the fact that a lot of elements of this policy were poorly communicated. So a lot of small business owners didn't really understand exactly under what terms they could or couldn't accept this loan in a forgivable, in a way that would make it forgivable if they retained staff. So I think there were a variety of elements to this program that made it a little bit too complicated to help a lot of small businesses that really needed it. And as a result, you're going to see a lot of what the caller just mentioned. Across the country, 50% is a figure that I'm hearing a lot. 50% is the decline essentially in restaurant revenue that you saw from February to April, 40 to 50%. You saw similar declines for retail across the country. I mean, in Washington, D.C., where I live, there is no retail that's open except for, Trader Joe's and Whole Foods and CVS. And so it's nearly inevitable that if you're a retailer that can't get access to an emergency loan and revenue goes down by 50%, you have to lay off half of your company. That's just how the math works. And that's why I'm still concerned that we're not at the end of the peak of unemployment. You could still see, you know, more people furloughed, more people laid off, more people claiming unemployment insurance. And that just means that this recession, this crisis that is already a once in a century event, could continue to spiral.
And just for some context here, some numbers out this morning, black small businesses down closed by 40%. And a call here, Matthew, from Jessica in Mille Lacs, who says, do your experts know what the cost would have been to guarantee people's paychecks for a time instead of giving every American a stimulus check? I mean, that's what some of the European countries did. I've had economists on the show who say it was just never going to happen. That's how they do things in Europe. It's not how we do things in the United States. Would it have been a better approach?
Well, I do think it's
worth it.
I was just going to ask Matthew. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay. I do think it's worthwhile thinking about what are some alternatives and what are the specifics that I think were wrong with the Paycheck Protection Program. So one thing that was a problem with the Paycheck Protection Program is that, of course, it went to existing businesses. We know that. So that means that's preventing people from being able to reallocate labor and capital to new and different endeavors. And the truth is that we can't pretend that the economy that comes out of this is going to be like the economy from January. We may need to see a lot more people in online work or in home delivery work, and a lot fewer people in face-to-face service interactions. So that's one problem. Another one is that, according to the rules, businesses had to spend 75% of their loans on payroll in order for the loans to be forgiven. Well,
right.
You know, for a lot of small businesses that have large rent payments, that's not really feasible. Another problem, one that's received a fair amount of attention, is the fact that the businesses, in many cases, in order to receive the loans, essentially had to keep things going exactly how they were. So probably the worst examples of this are the requirement that the airlines have to continue flying empty planes in order to receive their funds. And then another one that's received a fair amount of attention is the $600 a week boost to paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
We know, you know, from a recent University of Chicago study that I think it was 68% of those who are unemployed actually can make more on unemployment insurance based on this boost than they could working. So we want to help people, but that's a pretty big disincentive to get people back to work or to work in new and different ways that might be more useful. So what I would suggest would be a much better solution would essentially be a loan that's based on a line of credit that's based on people's deposits. So this is a proposal that the economist Arnold Kling suggested a few months ago. And the basic idea here is you look at what firms and what businesses deposited into their checking accounts in January and February. And you say, okay, if you're a small business and you deposited $100,000 in your checking account over that time period, we will give you a line of credit up to $100,000. And it'll be an interest. We'll charge you interest. It'll be modest 1% interest, which discourages people from taking out the loans that they don't need it. This is very simple. It doesn't require the government to have to second guess, you know, how much you should be spending your money on payroll versus rent payments. It doesn't involve this, you know, extraordinary disincentive for people to go back to work. It's a lot cleaner, simpler program. I don't think it's stimulative, but it does provide some relief and some liquidity to get people through the crisis.
Matthew, I thank you very much for the insight. I hope you'll come back. Good to have you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Derek, I have one last fast question for you. We just heard Matthew say he believes, and I know there's argument about this, about the disincentive because of the extra over and above unemployment insurance. Do you think that's going to be renewed?
My expectation from talking to people on the Hill is that right now you have a law in place that gives people on unemployment insurance a $600 per week bump. I think when it's renewed, you're going to have a bump that is higher than zero, but lower than 600. So let's say it's 300. That means the disincentive will be reduced. And then if it's renewed again, it might be renewed only at a $200 per week bump, meaning the work disincentive is further reduced. I think people want to work. I think they want to get back to their jobs, especially if they feel like they can do their jobs in a healthy way that doesn't expose them to a murderous pathogen. I do hope that we do continue unemployment insurance with some kind of benefit, because we don't want people to starve. And we also want to pay people to remain healthy. If they can't work because they are employed in a job that puts them into contact with a pathogen, we want to make sure that we are protecting them because they've been disemployed through no fault of their own.
Derek, thanks for the article, and definitely thanks for the time in talking about it today.
My pleasure.
Derek Thompson's article is called "We Can Prevent a Great Depression. It'll Take $10 Trillion in the Atlantic."
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!